Welcome to Our House, the only complete on-air resource for your home ownership needs. Now, here's the host of Our House, Peter Hunt.
Good morning and welcome to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and this show is brought to you by the all-new HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. HuntRealEstate.com is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA here in Buffalo, Niagara, all across upstate, even out to Phoenix, Arizona. And the show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage. I encourage you to call them today, 633-3700, and ask one of our skilled mortgage consultants to work with you to find the lowest rate and closing costs for your particular home financing needs and wants, and also ask about our many exclusive programs, including our pre-purchase commitment that allows you at no cost or risk to effectively enter the market to find your next home with cash. So call today, 633-3700, for service that we know will be personalized, it will be customized, and it will knock your socks off. Don't forget about the first ever 24/7 365 real estate hotline, the Hunt Hotline, which gives you access to all available information about any property listed for sale here in Buffalo, Niagara, all across upstate, and then out to Phoenix, Arizona. All you have to do for local listings is call 716-631-4800. Enter the street number of the house you want to know about, no matter whose listing it is. It doesn't have to be ours. The hotline will prompt you with a choice of street name. Select the one you want. You'll hear a brief description. Then you'll be texted a link to a dedicated website on that particular property, all automatically and just that fast, anytime in any market we serve on any listing, whether it's ours or any other brokers. We're constantly updating how robust those individual property websites are, so I encourage you to go there today. It's much faster than even Googling a listing on your phone. I assure you this is the best way to do it. We have a very interesting marketplace here today, and we're going to be talking about that in just a couple minutes here, but I want to remind our listeners that Hunt is the official real estate and relocation provider for our hometown professional teams, the Buffalo Bills, the Buffalo Sabres, and the Rochester Americans. We are broadcast live here on WBEN 930 AM, and for those of you who'd like to participate in today's show, you can reach us here in the studio at 803-0930 or 1-800-616-9236 if you're long distance, or star 930 if you're mobile. Those are all free calls. Call us here at in the studio at our house. And also, if you'd like to text us, you can text us at 30930. So please do that, and you can stay right in touch with us here. We've got a great show for you today, a very special show for you today. In the studio with me today is John Hurley. Mr. Hurley is the president of Canisius College. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Peter.
It's good to have you with us, John. I'm going to ask you to bear with me for a minute here, if you would. I'm going to do something that we've never done here, and that's editorialize. Most of the time, it's about you, and it will be about you in just a minute. But I just want to share some thoughts with our listeners on, I guess, the elephant here in the studio, the elephant in our lives right now, which is, of course, this coronavirus issue. Since last Friday, I've been in daily touch with our people as this whole thing has been unfolding, as it became clear that there were going to be kind of radical changes in our life. And I must say that the 1,800 people associated with our company have been beyond respectful, supportive, and supportive not just of the company, but of their customers who are challenged today like they've never been challenged. Our people have supported the customers in the pipeline right now, are people seeking mortgages, people looking for insurance, people getting title work done. And I must say how impressed I am with our people and the way they've supported themselves, their families, and their customers. But yesterday was a little different. We had an executive leadership meeting yesterday morning, about 17 of us. And about halfway through the meeting, we learned that the governor was going to be imposing, as of Monday, pretty much a lockdown on the entire population of New York State. There are obviously exceptions, but all of a sudden our world changed overnight. We could no longer, according to this, do business the way we were used to doing it. And this is a real problem for us. So since then, and really all along, I've been listening and watching the hundreds of reports, and I found that there were only two in the last 2 days on testing. So I started thinking about, really, how do we flatten this curve and flatten it fast? And I'm going to put it in two words: universal testing. Every man, woman, and child in this country. People will say, well, there are not enough tests. Oh, we've thought of that. That's not practical. Who would conduct the tests and who would evaluate the results? Well, let's just say for a minute that the tests could be made available, that the evaluation process could be fast-tracked, that there was a tracking system that was national, secure, and universal already in place, and then an identification system for everyone in the form certification first and then identification in public. In some forms, like for example, a simple colored bracelet, green would be an indicator that you were negative, yellow that it was positive with no symptoms, a red bracelet would mean you're positive with symptoms, and a purple would mean that you're positive with acute symptoms. Everyone would then be channeled, green, return to normal life, yellow, quarantined at home for a minimum 14 days, red, hospitalized and treated until asymptomatic, then quarantined at home for 14 days, purple, intensive care hospitalization until the infection subsides. Businesses are reopened. People go back to work. The devastation to the economy and the American lifestyle begins to repair itself relatively soon. So how would we test 330 million people, less the 60,000 that have already been tested? Well, number one, we'd start with the most easily identifiable and easy to organize groups, where they could be tested at a familiar, comfortable site. After which they would return to their residence to remain in current stay-at-home state until test results were received. These groups would include all students and their families, every first responder, hospital worker and caregiver of all kinds, every patient in an inpatient setting, every senior housing worker, caregiver, and resident, every employee at an organized for-profit business, every union member, every employee at a not-for-profit entity, every member or volunteer of a faith-based, community-wide membership or donor-based organization like all churches, synagogues, mosques, the YMCA, even the Jewish Center and the United Way. We would set up drive-through evens, as they now are doing in Israel. Secondly, we would use the same method now used for the 2020 census. We would that's direct mail with an appointment date and time afterwards, and even a more primitive means, door-to-door. If step one was completed first, step two would be expedited. How hard would it be to piggyback on or replicate the process already designed and being implemented? Thirdly, make testing process a requirement to vote. I can hear the screams already, but surely this is a better alternative to what is otherwise a given for millions now, a job lost and or dependency on our government for bailout. I would bet that if a call was made for volunteers for this effort, thousands would line up for help, to help, I should say. For volunteering, they would be the first tested. Restaurants, gaming establishments, most hospitality venues, automobile manufacturing plants, and almost all retail businesses are now closed, and the vast majority of us are sitting at home doing what? In less than one full week, the commercial and social environment in this country has been turned upside down, and trillions, trillions of dollars of assets have been erased. In a few short weeks, lifelong dreams of a graduation ceremony from high school or college, major and minor league sporting events, vacations and other travel plans, weddings, parties, fundraising events, dinners out with friends and family, all trashed. All one time, never to be repeated events gone. And for what? Our safety? Our health? So we can watch another press conference only to learn how little we know about what this nightmare will be, when this nightmare will be over, and how much of our freedom, and social fabric is being destroyed. The normal expected government response, beyond the new form of martial law we were living under, is to throw money at the problem. Even if that is the answer, how long will it take to spread it around in such a way as to solve the problems in the economy now spiraling out of control? And then there's the blame game. It's the Chinese. Oh no, it's the president. No, it's the Italians, or it's the Iranians, or the Russians, or Congress. Who cares? Certainly not the now unemployed server at the local formerly popular restaurant, or the pilot for American Airlines, or the UAW member, or the single mother or father now forced to wait for a government check or rent abatement just to get through the next month. Do we honestly believe more than $1 trillion thrown at this by Congress, plus the multiple hundreds of billions infused into the financial system by the Federal Reserve, will repair the damage created in just the last week? Will that $1 trillion plus invested produce a return anywhere near the multiple trillions of dollars in asset value that vaporized since March 16th? Will that $1 trillion plus help us to avoid a 20% drop in the GDP in the second quarter of 2020? With the very real prospect of huge drops in future quarters? Will that $1 trillion plus bring back the thousands of small businesses the government is forced to close that will never reopen? And will that $1 trillion plus create jobs to replace the millions of jobs that are already or are well on their way to being lost, many for good? I've listened to the commentators and politicians night after night, and read dozens of articles on this pandemic and even other pandemics from the past. The only way to flatten the curve and bring peace of mind and some sanity back to the American people is by answering the question of who is infected with this COVID-19. Isolate them and get them the care they need. Solve the testing and care problems. Even a vaccine can wait. It will take many months or even years under the best of circumstances. Could a universal testing program cost $1 trillion? I don't think so. We are already willing to spend that now, and absolutely no end date in sight for the clampdown on society or even the semblance of assurance that the problem will be solved. Let's push our government officials and the healthcare and scientific community to fast-track the testing and treatment system now and put some light at the end of this awful, dark tunnel. Well, John, that's my introduction. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. And I don't know if you have any reaction to that. That was not my first question, believe it or not. But if you do, I'd be happy to listen.
Well, I think on the issue of testing, that this week in Erie County, the flaws in this reliance on testing have been exposed. 450 tests were all that we could conduct in a metropolitan area of about 1 million people. And I don't mean to alarm people, but the problem, I've read any number of reports, for every confirmed case, given that we're not testing widely enough, there are how many, 20, 30 unconfirmed cases walking around? And that's what causes the great concern out there, people being afraid to engage in normal social interaction.
So lock everybody down, right?
Well, that's been the response, because we don't have the test kits available to run the tests on the scale that we'd like to.
And that's the classic politician response.
Yeah.
Well, why not mobilize? We can mobilize all kinds of other things. Why not mobilize that? We have an amazing society, amazingly productive people, amazingly creative people, amazingly resourceful people. Yet what we do, we're sitting here waiting for the government to bring the helicopter in and drop money on us. To me, this is insane. But let's get off of that just for a second. What I'd like to really have you start with, John, is to explain what's going on at Canisius right now and how you've dealt with all this.
Well, this has been a two-plus-week process, Peter. We have 900-plus students and residents in the campus at any one time. And as we saw back in 2008 during the H1N1 outbreak, an influenza strain will ripple through a residence hall of young adults, because they're living in such close quarters. They're sharing bathrooms. They're in confined quarters. So we had to reach the conclusion early on, and this was early last week, that the students needed to leave the residence halls and go home. We got some pushback, and I understand, because here you are in the middle of the semester, and we're telling students you have to go home. And parents were upset about that, saying, well, we would rather them be at the college. But the problem is we looked at it, is we weren't set up to take care of students when they were sick. And so so they would be better off with a loved one at home. The second part then was to figure out, what do you do about the remaining part of the semester? We were 9 weeks into the semester. We had 6 weeks to go. Is it possible to pivot to a completely online instruction? Frankly, at Canisius, we pride ourselves on what goes on in the classroom, and it's that interaction with the faculty member standing in front and the creative things that happen in the classroom. So this is not to say that online is impossible, but it's not our brand. And yet I've watched over the last week, incredible resolve and cooperation from our faculty and those in the academic division of the colleges. We got prepared on roughly 2 weeks' notice to just pivot to an online instruction and to complete the semester so that these students didn't lose the investment of the 10 weeks that they had. So that will begin on Monday. We've been on spring break all this week, and we will return virtually on Monday. And we're lucky in the sense that while we don't have online education at the undergraduate level on a wide scale, we use a pretty sophisticated industry leader learning platform. So syllabi are posted online, class notes are posted online, assignments are submitted through that. You can manage a course through what we already have in place. We didn't have to create that. But it's now the faculty member is forced to think about the course content. If there was going to be an in-person exam, how are we going to do that if we're in this online environment? So we're working through all those issues, and we'll see come Monday morning how that starts to play out.
Well, you mentioned something very important there, that Canisius College has built itself really around the personal part of the education, person to person, and how kind of antithetical this whole situation is to that. You are prepared to do it virtually, which I appreciate, and many schools, frankly, because they tend to be on the leading edge of technology, I hope anyway, they're able to do this. And we've got to prepare, I guess, and I think this is a process that began a long time ago, we've got to prepare for the way people operate today, and they, more and more is done virtually, and certainly education is part of that. But it begs the question of what happens to schools like Canisius in the long run. I listened to one editorial this week where the speaker was blasting private education like you provide for its kind of lack of relevance to modern society, and I don't buy that, and I think it's a cheap shot, but the fact of the matter is there's a strong feeling in that direction these days, and only this kind of situation will only exacerbate that. Or don't you think that?
Well, it could. Yeah, I understand that. We've been under fire here from those who view the college experience as being very transactional and vocational in its orientation. That is, you come to college to prepare yourself to go get a specific job. And I don't say that we don't have our eye on that ball always, and we're talking about the return on investment for our families as they contemplate what is a large investment. But there's so much else to the process. This is about becoming more fully human, and becoming thinking and a sensitive, compassionate human being, someone able to engage the big issues in life. And if we're talking simply about a job training program, you don't get that. So I think study after study of the job market analytics in this country has shown that employers want students coming out of college with very sound critical thinking skills, with oral and written communication skills, good sense of ethics, and those things, they can be taught in a vocational program, but they tend to come from studying things like history and philosophy and theology. And then they get applied into a business setting or some other kind of vocational setting. So I'm confident in what we do, and I'm confident in the enduring relevance of it. So we'll just continue to push back against that narrative.
And I hope you do, because I find that, and I hope you do too, that people become more interesting the more well-rounded their thought process and their education is. If we're just taught how to build a widget, that's great, I'll get a job, but if what do I do after I go to work? What do I say to people? What do I read? What do I think about? How do I share with other people? And that's what a liberal arts education, to a large extent, helps to broaden in terms of just your breadth of thought.
Absolutely.
I just want to sidestep here for a second, John. The people are reacting to what I said, and they're saying that tests don't necessarily indicate that someone does have the virus. True, I guess we could improve the tests. Previous viruses were allowed to run their course, allowing millions to die. Should we merely accept that millions will die, or only the strong survive? Well, there's no proof that millions are going to die from this virus, and so I guess that remains to be seen. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm suggesting that we test people. We find out who has the virus. Right now, 60,000 people being tested in the entire United States out of a population of 330 million tells us nothing. Yep. We don't know anywhere near the extent of this thing. So everything we're talking about here is speculation until we know the extent of the spread of this virus. And sure, there's positive, false positives and false negatives and all kinds of stuff in every test, every medical test. Obviously, they get better over time, and you have fewer such results. But anyway, I appreciate what the people texting are saying, and I'm not suggesting this is the only solution. All I'm suggesting is the one that we're pursuing right now, throwing money at a problem, has no historical proof that this will help. None. Zero. At all. And so I would rather go with something that at least gives us one answer for one human being than for a universal answer that we know is going to blow a lot of money. We've already blown a lot of money in our culture in the last week alone, more than any other week at all, ever. And I guess that concerns me greatly, and I don't know what my other listeners might think, but I guess, again, John Hurley, I want you to talk about some things that are going on in our community today. You have been, among other things, besides what you do on campus, and I want to come back to that, but you've also been very involved with the Catholic Diocese and all the things going on there, and I don't want you to go in any depth that you don't want to go into, but I see you on television speaking for yourself and for the diocese. How do you see that situation, I guess, evolving, and also, and the importance of that, I think, is huge because of the number of people of the Catholic faith that we have in our community and really all through upstate, that this is a serious challenge, I guess, to people's faith and also to how the situation will be resolved.
Yeah, there are there's so many dimensions of this, Peter, but we've been working with a group called Leadership Roundtable, which was formed in Boston in 2002 by business leaders who said that we really needed to bring maybe better business organizational principles to bear on the Catholic Church as a way of ensuring that what has happened won't happen again. But more recently, Leadership Roundtable has been focusing on what they call the twin crises in the church. The first is this crisis of sex abuse, which I think we in the Buffalo Diocese are not certain that we're really at the bottom of this yet. We haven't gotten to the bottom. There are repeated calls for the bishop to release personnel records so that people have a better understanding of who made what decisions and that people can begin to make their own evaluations to how did that happen, why did that happen. And then simply addressing all of the victims of sexual abuse. This has been a horrible crime, a horrible stain on the church and on society. So that's one part of it. The second crisis, though, that they're focusing on is the crisis of leadership in the church, and that is how did this organization get to a point where something like this could occur? This is completely unfathomable. So we're trying to address both things.
I hate to cut you off there, and I want you to come back to that, but we do have to go to break. We'll be right back with more from our house tiers after these important messages.
Hi, this is Linda Malaya, president of Hunt Mortgage. Mortgage rates have recently dropped, and now is an ideal time to purchase a home and lock in a low rate. If you're already a homeowner, let's discuss your current mortgage. There may never be a better time to reduce your rate or access the equity in your home by refinancing with Hunt Mortgage. Call Hunt Mortgage at 633-3700 for a free, no obligation consultation.
Hunt Mortgage is a licensed mortgage banker, New York Department of Financial Services, and an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome back to our house. This is Peter Hunt, and this show is brought to you by the all-new HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience, and now essential because the options of face-to-face visits with our professionals are becoming restricted. And I encourage you to go to our website today. It's the only place on the web where you can find a complete inventory of homes available here in Buffalo Niagara, all across upstate, and even out to Phoenix, Arizona. And you'll also find access to a complete set of home ownership services at HuntRealEstate.com, which is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA. This show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, and for more information about our many exclusive programs, including the one that allows you to roll the cost of home improvements into your mortgage, allowing you to effectively buy the before and live the after, call us at 633-3700 and ask for details. Also, ask about our pre-purchase commitment I mentioned earlier, and even our warm home loan only at Hunt Mortgage, 633-3700. I'm in the studio today with John Hurley. Mr. Hurley is the president of Canisius College. And you know, I didn't ask you, John, and I'd like you to walk us back a little bit. We kind of got deep in the weeds there quickly. How did you become president of Canisius College? I've known you a long time. And, you know, from going way back in time, I never would have pictured you as president of Canisius College. But that's just me.
I was a surprise to my mother, too, at the time. But a little over 23 years ago, Peter, I was a partner at the Phillips Lytle Law Firm and was thinking about other opportunities in my life, and I took a job as the development and external relations person at Canisius, which is my alma mater and a place I felt very deeply about. throughout my life. And I was working with Father Vinnie Cook, the president, who was a great leader in this community, and never gave it a second thought. Thought I would maybe do this for the rest of my career or until I did something else. And when as time went on, when Father Cook got ready to retire, what became clear was the number of Jesuits available to fill the role of president of the Jesuit colleges and universities, we have 27 of them around the country, had really diminished. And I was kind of like the next best option, someone who had been at the school, a graduate of the school, and I'd worked very closely with Father Cook and was well immersed in the Jesuit network. So in 2010, I became the first lay president of the college.
But you're not the first lay president of any Jesuit school. Dr. DeGioia at Georgetown and I believe Fordham?
I was number three at the time. It was Georgetown, St. Peter's, and Lemoyne had lay presidents, and I was the fourth. And then, since then, of the 27, we have 15 lay presidents now. So that is more or less inevitable at this point, that there's going to be lay leadership in our schools.
And an evolution that's natural, I would think, and it's true of most institutions. I remember I have been very involved with YMCA, and pretty soon, out of necessity, some 25 years ago, the M and the C and the A kind of got dropped, and it just became the Y because the organization had to evolve. It was evolving on its own. There was no choice. And I think that's true of all institutions that may be church or religious-based in some way, shape, or form. And I'm not sure that's a terrible thing under any circumstances. But so you've been there now for a while. And what kind of stamp are you trying to put on Canisius? And I know that's an egotistical question. I'm not asking you to be. I know you're not that kind of guy. But what would you like to see happen at Canisius under your leadership?
Well, I think across the country, as we gather as presidents of Jesuit colleges, the big challenge right now with the move to lay leadership is how do we ensure that these schools remain authentically Jesuit? And that means that we need to understand what does it mean to be Jesuit and how do you do that when you don't have a lot of Jesuits on the campus? So if we've done anything in the past 10 years at Canisius, we've spent an enormous amount of time and effort on mission and identity work, and that is creating programs and opportunities for lay people to immerse themselves in this wonderful 500-plus year tradition of Jesuit education and to understand what that means for the world, because we think we really do have something unique to offer to the world.
And I think that's very important. We've got a whole bunch of texts coming in here, most of which have to do with the coronavirus 19, but there are some that are directly related to you. As a former seminarian, leadership did not let anybody stay in the seminary program if you had an opinion or had backbone. They want people who would not be ones that rock the boat. Is that just a feeling or on the part of that texter, or is that something that you've observed since you've been involved with this leadership roundtable?
I think there's a lot of truth to that, and I think Catholics all over the country, and particularly here in Buffalo in our movement to restore trust, we were looking at the state of seminary formation because obviously there was something about that created this group of people who were out.
A culture.
Yeah, a culture. That first of all, the culture of leadership, and then the individuals themselves who were engaged in these unspeakable acts. So I think the writer has something to say that's true there.
So in your leadership roundtable, not to keep dodging around various topics here, I really would like to focus on education and how education evolves in the current environment, but just how has the leadership roundtable addressed this issue in terms of training for priests?
Well, we're beginning to talk now, as they say, about seminary formation. Of course, we have in Buffalo the issue that the seminary will be closing. And so candidates from the Buffalo Diocese are going to have to seek their training in some other place. And I think that requires that whoever the bishop in Buffalo is going to need to look at the seminary and look at the culture of the place and the types of graduates they turn out. But I think this is a larger church issue, and certainly this is on the Pope's agenda. I think we may have gotten off track in terms of this whole formation of priests. And I say, you know, there's a kind of a knee-jerk reaction that the problem here is one of celibacy or one of the ordination of women. And I don't want to get to that issue for the minute. Let's just talk about the present situation of we're going to take celibate men and create great priests out of them. How would you best do that? There's got to be an awful lot of thinking on that because we're not on the right path for the church. We can see that.
That just one sentence seems almost unfathomable when you think about it. That's the way it's been for 1,000 years plus. So it's a very interesting and you know almost unmanageable problem. But let's go back to something that you manage every day, and that's the evolution of the educational system. We're in our face, as we were talking about earlier, is the whole transition from live education, person-to-person education, to distance learning, which is now being forced upon us to a large extent. You're one of many, many colleges, even here in New York State and locally, that are faced with this problem right now. And I've spoken with people at several of the schools, and it flies in the face of the whole kind of fundamental structure of the school while it was created, as you mentioned earlier. So what do you see happening, first of all, in the short run? And then you mentioned earlier that you have to go to this means, but how do you see families reacting? How do you see it shaking out maybe by the next semester in the fall, for example?
Yep. Well, I think the idea first is get through the 6 weeks that we have remaining in this semester and do the best we can by our students to make sure that they get what they need out of every course that they're enrolled in. And it won't be smooth. We hope it'll be as smooth as it can be, but there are going to be bumps as people adapt to this. Going forward, we would hope in the fall that we're back into in-person instruction. Although I have been urging, particularly in the undergraduate college at Canisius, that we give more thought to being able to more nimbly flip to online instruction, because when we have weather problems in Buffalo, we're under tremendous pressure from students and faculty and staff as to whether we close the college or not. And it's not the same kind of decision that gets made in the elementary and the secondary schools. So if we had the ability to ensure that work was continuing online, even in the midst of a weather problem, that might be a good thing. But, you know, Canisius already has about a dozen graduate programs that are either wholly or partly online. And this has been a great development in graduate education for working adults who can't be in a place at an appointed hour mm-hmm. to take a class. And so there's more convenience to it. And there are lots of great things that the technology puts at our hands here that we can use. And I think really improve the delivery of education. So I'm actually more bullish about incorporating technology and thinking about how you would make an online experience more interesting. For example, you could get the top lecturer in the world to talk about a particular topic, and you could tell your students, go watch that YouTube lecture. The classroom experience becomes completely different then. How do we unpack what was said there, and how do we solve problems and work on that? As opposed to come to class and hear the lecture, and then I'll give you some problems to go work on yourself at home.
And this is so interesting because all along, no matter how this shakes out, you've got buildings, you've got people, you've got built-in overhead like every school does, and at least in theory, spreading that cost over the current students and past students through donations, et cetera, has been the way that schools have been supported. Well, if there's students that are basically staying at home, they're going to want a different cost structure. So have you built new models as to how that might look? And then what do you do with the campus?
Yeah, so we've been thinking about that as we've been through a series of cost reduction strategies. And to tell you the truth, colleges and universities generally are not very efficient users of commercial space. We run these 15-week terms. We have a summer school that's mostly online. So you're using your physical plant about 30 weeks out or 32 weeks out of 52 weeks in the year. And we're trying to ask ourselves some hard questions about that. So that's going to continue to evolve. And I think as you look, we think the growth in higher education, to the extent that there will be, is going to be in the graduate arena, as people realizing that that four-year undergraduate degree, while essential, is not going to be enough to deal with all of the changes that this next generation and subsequent generations are going to go through in the workplace.
I have to ask you, your familiarity with private industry is extensive. Have you had any dialogue with private industry on how this evolution, forgetting the current crisis, but how this evolution will affect space needs in every business? Is that kind of dialogue taking place between universities and private industry, or is it just a matter of a company will come to a university or college and say, look, I need some help training or educating people in this area or that area?
I think that's just starting for us. For example, last year we struck a deal with the Catholic Health System where they were developing a sophisticated electronic patient's record system and needed space and saw some synergies by operating on a college campus. So they have 20,000 square feet of space at the Canisius campus right now. And it was a kind of an exciting proposition because you'd say, well, we're going to go in for this project, but who knows what it will turn into.
I got to ask you to hold that thought, and it's a very important thought. We'll come back with more from John Hurley after these very important messages.
Hi, this is Linda Malaya, president of Hunt Mortgage. Mortgage rates have recently dropped, and now is an ideal time to purchase a home and lock in a low rate. If you're already a homeowner, let's discuss your current mortgage. There may never be a better time to reduce your rate or access the equity in your home by refinancing with Hunt Mortgage. Call Hunt Mortgage at 633-3700 for a free, no obligation consultation.
Hunt Mortgage is a licensed mortgage banker, New York Department of Financial Services, and an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome back to our house. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the all-new huntrealestate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. And the show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, home of the pre-purchase commitment and the second look program, one of the greatest things that our president, Linda Malaya, has ever come up with. And that very simply says that if you've already been qualified for a loan or you think you're on the way to working with another lending institution, let us take a look at it. Let's take a second look. The worst that can happen is that we'll give you a gift certificate for $50. Very worst that can happen. The best thing that happened is you find out that you're paying too much and we can make a better deal for you. 633-3700. I'm in the studio today with John Hurley, the president of Canisius College. And before we get back to what I think is probably the key question, really, in terms of business and universities and colleges working together, and that's how the work environment evolves, the need or lack thereof of physical space for people to go to as in a business or a college. I want to come back to that. But there's a bunch of messages up here, including one that says, I'm panicking. Stop it. Anyway, that's probably true. Okay, I'm not going to stop it, but maybe I am panicking. I don't know. What's the end game until there's a vaccine or a cure? I'm stuck in the house because the virus is everywhere. And here's one for you. The church has to open its books. No transparency, no credibility. And I believe you're well on the way to that. You can respond to that in a second. I agree with your intro. I wish you would have followed it up with a local doc or CDC rep. What is wrong at the CDC that caused them to be so slow at getting tests developed? It cannot be a lack of staff. Is this political? What was the reason the WHO test was not used here? I recently read an article stating that we, government, knew for many years that a pandemic was a real possibility someday. Of course. I mean, there's been ones in the past. There's going to be more in the future. Anyway, there's Latin there that probably only you can understand.
Not even me.
Okay.
You know, Peter, my dad was born in 1918 in Boston, and I remember talking to him throughout his life. He was always very grateful that he survived that great Spanish influenza.
My grandfather, too.
Yeah, just it was amazing.
Well, it was a very, you know, the masks they were using at that time were totally ineffective. Totally ineffective. Some people walk around thinking they were safe, and they were just spreading the disease.
Yeah.
I mean, we've come a long way since then. Back to the point about the academy and business and how they can better cooperate. The focus, for example, at Stanford and other kind of major centers for that kind of cooperation has always been kind of product or service or technology driven. In other words, let's invent something and figure out a way to develop it, commercialize it, take it to market, and the school becomes wealthy as a result. That's certainly a model Stanford has observed. Harvard, a lot of the major institutions go that route. Is that a viable option for a school like Kinesis to work closely with local industry to develop products, services, goods, whatever it might be, to be a use of the intellectual capital on campus as well as a service to the local business community?
We have a limited opportunity there, I would say. We are primarily a teaching college. There is great research that's done there. But the kind of cutting-edge new discovery type things are really concentrated in the Research One universities. Having said that, we have an Institute for Autism Research that is contributing an enormous amount to the body of knowledge of how to treat kids with high-functioning autism spectrum disorders. And they've got a very open view of this. Their results are government-funded. And they share their results willingly with educators so that they can help kids. So that's the kind of smaller thing that Kinesis would be doing.
And I think that's remarkable, masterful work, because that's, for some reason, it's becoming a very much a top-of-mind thing in society today, that autism, I mean, when I was growing up, you heard about it maybe here and there, once or twice a year. Now it's almost a daily event in the press somewhere that there's some research going on or something evolving. And the spectrum, as you refer to, it's not just one condition. It's a whole series and a whole spectrum of conditions. So how do you work with local industry along those lines?
Well, we would work with the school districts and educators. So we're running workshops. We're inviting teachers into our what we call a Summer Max program, which is an on-site program that runs for 6 or 8 weeks in the summer. These kids come in and they're learning coping techniques. So the teachers are in the room when the kids are learning these and just observing, and they are then encouraged to take some of these things into their own classrooms because this is a spectrum, these things exist on a spectrum, and because so many of these kids want to be mainstreamed, more teachers need to know how to accommodate these kids in the classroom and to help them be well adjusted and accepted by their fellow students. So that part is good. And the other part is we're publishing studies regularly on this, and which is why our two directors of this program have been so fabulously successful in getting federal grants. They're competing with all of the best research universities for this money, and the quality of what's being done there is being recognized.
We should recognize that as a feather in the cap of our community, and I appreciate what you're doing. We have a caller on the line. John, this is Gustav from Williamsville. Gustav, how can we help you?
Well, briefly, there's a predominant, overwhelming leftward tilt to university faculty and students within the world. United States particularly. Does Kinesis in any way see itself as a counterbalance to any of that?
Interesting. I don't know how you would measure that, but I'm sure there's some thought going into that. How do you react to a comment like that?
No, I hear that, and I understand where that comes from. I had a former trustee say that same thing to me down in Florida recently, and I said that's really painting all of higher education and all students in higher education with an incredibly broad brush. And frankly, as I interact with our students at Kinesis, I think it's unfair. So what are we doing? First of all, there are some, we think there's truth in the world. That's what universities are about. And in our Catholic tradition, it's derived from a faith in God and what we learned from the example of Jesus Christ. So at a Jesuit university, we're committed to the search for truth, and that means, I think, a balanced perspective in exposing students to a wide range of views and letting them pick things that they understand as truth. And I get really concerned about political correctness on both ends on the college campus. Both on the, on the right and the left, as you were. So we'd like to be more balanced on that. I think sometimes there's a tendency to say we're too liberal. Frankly, when one person's liberal view may be another person's social justice view compelled by the example of Jesus Christ. So I don't know how to sort that out. But I think at Canisius, I think we do a better job of balancing this. And, you know, so many of our students come from Buffalo and the area, and this is not, I would say, a super radical place anyway. So I think we try to strike the right balance is the best I can say.
Yeah, well, that's extremely interesting. You know, I wonder, though, how much any administration of any college can control the shaping of thinking that takes place in the classroom in any given class.
Academic freedom really prohibits that kind of and a president walks down that path at his peril, I'll tell you. So it's a question of encouraging things, maybe finding money from donors who want more conservative views expressed, and we've done that kind of thing on the campus. Trying to ensure that you're representing all views in big lecture series and things like that. But when you try to get into the individual classroom, don't do that.
You know, there is a question up there that doesn't exactly go to this issue, but certainly what I know you must be facing, because I know every college president is facing it today, and says, based upon students going home, is it appropriate for college to discuss refunds, partial or otherwise? And how do you address that when a family calls you and says, well, my kid's not taking advantage of what I've already paid for?
Yeah, so this on Thursday, I sent a communication out to the entire campus community and said, in light of the fact that we're not going to complete this term on site and the students moved home, we're going to do the right thing by our students and issue pro rata refunds for the room and board in the dorm. I saw yesterday that the Wall
Street... Oh, you are?
We are.
Oh, great.
We've committed to doing that. And
I think you're one of the few schools I've heard of that's doing that.
You know, our polling on it and what I've seen in the national media suggests that, well, at least in the Jesuit world, 75% were already there, maybe almost 100%.
I'm glad to hear that, because that's among the first I've heard of that. That's great.
Yeah, so we'll do that. And it's the more troubling thing is a piece I saw in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that said, well, should they refund tuition too? And frankly, we think if we can complete the semester online and give students a good experience and issue the credits that they've earned, that we wouldn't refund tuition, but the room and board, yes.
I imagine that puts a strain on any college's budget, because the costs are still there to a large extent, beyond food itself that you're not serving.
Well, it really is lost revenue, yeah. And the residence halls are there, and they're empty, so we're not getting anything from them.
I'm not going to – we don't have time to deal with the – the criticism of us not following the Catholic tradition, but I don't know if you have a comment on that. But I
think we are. I mean, I feel I'm in full communion with the Catholic Church, and I stay in close touch with the bishop, and the Canisius College has always enjoyed a great relationship with the bishop here. So I think, again, people's interpretation of what might constitute the Catholic tradition is all over the place.
I just want to assure our listeners that one person texted earlier that we shouldn't even be on the air because of the restrictions in society today. But I want you all to know that John is at least 6 feet from me, so we're practicing social distance right here in the studio. And I agree with that. We probably shouldn't be here, but the fact of life is some aspects of life must go on, and we want to do our part here to encourage that, as I tried to state in my earlier comments. In any event, John Hurley, any last words for us about how you see Canisius evolving in the short term beyond the obvious threats that we're experiencing?
Well, Peter, you know, we're in the midst this year of celebrating the college's sesquicentennial, 150 years, begun back in 1870 in a little printing house down on Ellicott Street in downtown Buffalo. And I keep saying to people, who would have thought it would have emerged as it has, as a real leader in the community, a source of great pride and support, and the question right now in these present challenges is, how do we keep it going? And we've got a lot of people committed to it, alumni, faculty, staff, benefactors, so we're looking forward, not backward.
Well, there's many graduates out there, as you know. This community is full of them, and I want to congratulate you for what you're doing at Canisius College. It's a beautiful campus, great programs taking place there, and I want to hope for the best for your school as we go forward. Thank you very much for being with us, John.
Thanks, Peter.
It's great to have you here. And I'd like to thank our listeners for being with us. We'll be back again next week at the same time. And remember, when it comes to real estate, all of upstate is Hunt Country.